Hey there, welcome to another episode of Dangerous But Good. And I've been looking very forward to this one. An old friend, a colleague, a brother, someone I've done amazing work with, Khalil Osiris, over in the US. And, you know, when I start talking to Khalil, we just can't stop talking. It's beautiful. But Khalil, thanks for joining, man. Brother, great to reconnect and lovely to hear what you've been doing in the last 2 years. Let me just kick off by introducing Khalil. He's one of America's foremost authorities on re-entry success. Khalil himself was incarcerated for 20 years, and we'll talk a lot about that. But during his incarceration, turned his life around, got a bachelor's degree, a master's degree. He works a lot with second chance hiring, which I love. You know, it's the whole redemption process. Workforce development for justice impact individuals. He's also been called professor for a course, a groundbreaking course he developed called Psychology of Incarceration, and which is now implemented in correctional facilities around America. So, Khalil, welcome, brother. So good to be chatting to you, and I look forward to this conversation. It's already started.
It's great. It's great for us to restart our conversations, bro. It's been a while, and having been in South Africa for 6 or 7 years, and having an opportunity to really kind of be on the ground and see the great work that you're doing and participate at some level. I'm just really excited that you and I have had a chance through our travels to revisit the conversations we were having for that rough period of time of just kind of seeing what's possible, how we can engage, how we can make change in a way that's reflective of our mission, of our purpose, of what we see as important for us to do. So it's an honor, brother, to be back in conversation with you and to have a chance really to address some of the serious issues that that so many of us are grappling with culturally, societally, on every level.
Well, I mean, the world has changed quite radically in the last few years. And you know, some of it's funny, some of it's tragic, some of it's wild and just kind of, you know, where did this come from? So, and I think more than ever, a conversation amongst men around issues of polarization and all the nonsense that we're seeing, you know, the divisions and the hatred and the cancel culture. And it's just insane, isn't it? You know, in many ways, we've just lost our humanity and our brotherhood. And what's fascinating too, you know, me being here in South Africa and you in the US is how South Africa is now on the radar again in the US, isn't it? You know, we've got refugees coming to America. We've got
59 refugees have been accepted into the US under refugee status of being persecuted in their home country.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's all the talk. In the United States, people are arguing, people are upset, some people are celebrating.
Right.
I mean, I just think that this is a great jump off point to really talk about how an issue like this has galvanized our attention between two countries that historically have been very similar in ways in terms of the challenges that we faced.
Yeah.
I mean, the issue of race and economics have been so intertwined to our conversations in America and South Africa that now to be at this stage is to me quite interesting.
It's fascinating. Because,
if you had an opportunity to travel to a country where you believe there was more opportunity than the country you were in. That's as basic as it gets to me.
Yeah. So for the individual, it's almost a non-brainer.
No question about it. Yeah. I think that they're making the 59 people that have come from South Africa made that choice based on their individual circumstances.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I really think that's what all of us do for the most part. We look at our circumstances and we make decisions based on how we assess our individual circumstances.
Right. Yeah.
And so at that level, I don't think there's anything shocking or outrageous about the fact that you could find 59 people and actually many, many more who would jump at an opportunity to leave South Africa and try their hand in America.
Yeah. Well, you know,
that's not outrageous to me.
It's not. And, you know, in every situation, there are lies and there are truths, aren't they? I mean, and that's the thing. Yeah. And the problem with the world we're living in right now is we polarize. We tend to be in this box or that box. You're a Republican and you hate Democrats, or you're a Democrat and you hate Republicans. It's binary. And it's such a false view of the world, isn't it? You know, it's so false.
Yes.
Because before any of that, we're human beings. Human beings, yes. Human first. And I mean, that quote, please remind me of that quote you love to share.
By Maya Angelou.
Maya Angelou. Yes.
I'm human, therefore anything human is familiar to me. There's nothing human that is foreign.
I love that. And I love that because the capacity for good and evil exists in every single human being. Black or white, whatever your culture, your ethnicity, your background, your nationality, your religion, no one is immune from the capacity to be evil and also the capacity to be godlike and brilliant and good.
Absolutely.
And we need to offer each other grace and understanding, and we need to hone into the truth, don't we? Where is the truth? You know, sometimes the truth is found in my enemy. Sometimes the error is found in my brother, you know, and let's find it, man, and let's pursue it. Don't you wish the world was more like that? Let's pursue the truth.
Brother, the thing that, when I look at some of the challenges that we're facing, particularly around race, what's clear to me is that if we remove the element of race as an obvious point of disagreement or conflict, as human beings, we create another
exactly.
issue.
Exactly.
If we didn't have race, we'd invent something new.
Yeah.
So you've got people who never talk about race, but who talk about body shaming.
Right, right.
Who talk about all kinds of other issues.
Politics,
it's
religion.
It's not race isn't top of mind.
Yeah.
So it tells me something about our humanity.
Yeah.
That if we are not thoughtful, if we are not conscious, it's very easy to be compulsively racist, to be compulsively unaware, to be compulsively everything that we know is a challenge to our well-being. It's easy to be wrong.
Yeah. Well, don't you think it's tribalism is a good word? Whatever my tribe is.
I think you nailed it right there. Yeah, I think that's the word. That's the word I was searching for, is tribalism.
I belong to this tribe, and this tribe is right. We don't ever look in the mirror and say, you know, maybe my tribe is behaving in a way that's not exactly how things should be. And maybe that tribe who I've hated all my life has actually got some good in them, you know? I mean, isn't that the way it is? You know, the humility of just saying, man, I could be wrong. You could be right. You know, we're human. I've screwed up. You've screwed up. You know, let's get on with it, you know?
Of course. I mean, for me, the biggest challenge has been over the last 25, 30 years, how can I hold myself accountable for the things that I say I believe, and for my goal of being a better human being? Mm. Like, how does that actually happen if I'm unwilling to change?
It'll never happen.
It's just not possible.
Yeah. Yeah.
And change means I've got to rethink some of the things I believe.
Yeah.
I've got to reevaluate that which I've called the truth about myself as a starting point.
It's a profound starting point. In fact, it's the only point you can begin to change from, isn't it?
Yes.
Looking in the mirror.
Absolutely. Well,
honestly, looking in the mirror.
And I think that the more we do the work of personal transformation, the less angry we are at other human beings.
Yeah.
You know, because you see the immensity of the work in front of you on yourself.
Yeah.
And once you get a clear picture of that, you have much more empathy for the next person who's also struggling to be a better human being.
Very much.
And maybe that's not on their radar yet. Maybe being a better human being isn't on their radar. What I do know is that the desire for good is inherent to every human being. So if it's not expressed the way that I express it, what I need to do is recognize they just have a different way of saying it than I
right,
do.
Right.
That's all.
Don't you absolutely hate the concept of canceling, and particularly canceling people for something they did 10, 15, 25 years ago? It's insane because it just eliminates the possibility of growth, grace, redemption. I mean, as I said, we've all, you know, those who live in glass houses shouldn't throw stones. We all live in a glass house. And if I'm digging
every
up something,
one of us.
I'm digging up something you did 10 years ago. What I'm saying is, you know, it's almost like, you know, physical wounding. We all wound ourselves. I mean, you and I have both been heavily involved in sports and activities. Yeah. I mean, you wound, you break something. Imagine if that break never healed. And that's how we treat people. You know, I mean, we wound, but we heal. And there's a scar, but we've learned from that, you know. And I think in terms of our social interaction, the things we've said and done, man, I'm not the same person as I was 10 years ago when I said that thing.
Totally. I when I look at my life and in the context of cancel culture, I would be invisible. Literally. I'd just be invisible. Because
you'd walk around with a sign, a bell around your head saying, you know, unclean.
There'd be no point. Yeah, there would be no point in me doing anything, saying anything. Mm. I could never be forgiven for the things that I've done because having served 20 years in prison and encountering someone who says, well, I'm going to cancel you. I just welcome that kind of foolishness. Cancel me?
Bring it on. Okay. Bring it on, brother. Bring it on.
You cannot survive in the mud that I've lived in. So you want to call me a criminal. You want to call me a murderer. You want to call me whatever you want to call me. It's not new. It's not my first rodeo.
Yeah. But also it's not who I am now.
It's of course not. And that's really that's what we can laugh at.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
That's what allows us to laugh at those who are serious about canceling anyone.
Yeah.
When you have changed, when you have owned your choices and your behavior, your actions in the world, then you welcome reconciliation.
You do.
You welcome the opportunity to reconcile.
Yeah.
Your behavior with your values, or your thinking with your words. That's a welcoming opportunity.
And you have empathy, don't you?
Yes. Yes, brother. Just think about the fact that someone who dislikes you so much that they consciously dig into your life to find something that you've said that is not aligned with a position you're applying for or with the cultural norms of today.
Yeah.
Well, that's probably likely for all of us.
Every one of us. If our entire life was recorded, we would not be happy to have it displayed today.
Oh my God!
Because we've all screwed up.
It's just such a ridiculous notion.
It really
is. And I think that there has to be more of us who are unafraid of being canceled.
Yeah, yeah.
But to have their voice.
But I mean, that point is so powerful, Khalil, because we're afraid of being canceled. Open, honest, authentic, real discussion, it no longer exists. People are too scared to talk. And if we're too scared to talk, how can you ever discover the truth? How can you find out what's real if you can't talk? You know, a lot of the YouTube clips we put out there, isn't it insane that if you say the word rape, for instance, you're likely to guess less, the algorithm's not going to support you because you used. Now, the word rape is a terrible, terrible word, but it's a very real word. It happens. It's a reality. You can't hide from it. Suicide is another terrible, dreadful tragedy. My own brother committed suicide. But, you know, if you protect me from the word suicide, you're not helping me. You know, I've got to embrace it and go, you know, so the realities of life are harsh and brutal. And if we protect people from them and cancel people who use, it's just insane. We're raising a generation of spineless wimps, aren't we? Because we're not having authentic, real conversation.
Yeah, we're afraid. First of all, we've allowed ourselves to be in these boxes that have pretty titles. that we've cultivated over a period of our lives, of being in conversation with people who say these things, that we're not really thinking deeply about what it means when you say that you're going to cancel a person.
Yeah.
We're not thinking deeply about that, because if you did, you'd have to start with, what is it you've said that somebody can cancel you for?
Exactly. Exactly.
What have you said? What have you done? Mm. Not what someone else has said and done. Mm. And if you can start with yourself and really do a deep dive there, then what happens is you are less likely to point the finger at someone else.
Absolutely.
You got too much work to do yourself.
But for the grace of God, there go I.
Totally.
You know, Khalil, I mean, I've had very limited, thank goodness, experience with prison. You've had vast experience. But the one time, twice I've spoken at prisons, the one Leeuwkop prison down the road from us here in South Africa. And it was quite a life-changing experience, because I was invited to do the keynote address for a group of prisoners who'd been through a program. And I went there, and there were 20 of them. And these were men, you know, medium security prison. And many of them, I think the least had been there for 7 years. And I just felt such an incredible love for these men, because when I looked in their eyes, I did not see bad men. I saw good men who wanted to be good men, and who'd had a tough, tough life, and their life had taken a wrong turn, and they'd done something which they now deeply regretted. And afterwards, after I did my talk, I went down and I just said to the guys, you know, I'm going to give you a hug. And Khalil, when I embraced the first guy, he would not let go. He was just holding on. And I realized this guy is crying out for love and effort. And then I went through all 20 and the guys clung on to me. It was, I barely held it together. I got back to the car and I just broke down and I wept. I wept for the life that those men had had, a tough, difficult, horrible childhood, for decisions they'd made that they deeply regret. And I wept for a system which, for me, is broken. It doesn't, you know, you lock a man up who like that. It's dehumanizing. It's dreadful. It, you know, and then them coming back into society, they're labeled, you know, and it was such a powerful transformative experience for me, seeing these men and realizing, you know what, they're not bad men. You know, I guess a certain percentage of men behind bars are, you know, they're bad. they've had choices. Yeah. They continually make the wrong choice, and they enjoy killing or whatever. I mean, yeah. I think there is a percentage of men that are evil, and that's a different story, but the vast majority are not, you know. And I mean, your work has been phenomenal, having been in the depths of that jungle, come out, seeing how society reacts to you, and developed a course around that psychology. And I just love this topic of redemption, that every man, every woman deserves a chance at redemption. And we need to create a society which allows them to be redeemed.
You hit the nail on the head, Craig. First of all, starting with how powerful your experience was going inside the prison and seeing men who were hungry for a word of encouragement, for wise advice, and for relationship.
Brotherly love.
With brotherly love, approval and recognition, an I see you moment, if you will, man to man.
Yep.
And so that is something which is a very important aspect of understanding that how people at the bottom of life still desire good, still desire wellness and positive relationships and all those wonderful things that most of us take for granted.
Yeah.
And so that aspect is always kind of at the center of how do we think about transformation with people who have really struggled in their lives. And what I found, Craig, is this. When it comes to crime, as we typically think about it, it's really important for people to own their choices, to own their story. And what I mean by that is, from my, and I'll just use myself as an example. I was convicted and sent to prison. And when I got there, what was clear to me is that I was responsible for the choices I made, the crime I committed. And there was no one who could change that.
Right.
I had to embrace it. No amount of pointing fingers and blaming society could change it. Only I could change it. So that meant I had more power than my circumstances.
Right.
Because my circumstances were my past that led me there. Now, in the situation that I find myself in prison, I have a choice to make. Will I continue on that path, or will I make every effort to be a better human being?
Fantastic.
And oftentimes when you go into programs like you were part of and the keynote speaker for, you are coming in contact with those individuals who have made a conscious decision to work on being better human beings.
Yeah.
That's the thing that you encounter. And anywhere you go in the world where you have a group of people who are hungry for transformation, it is going to be inspiring.
Absolutely.
It is going to be transformational for the person who goes there or who has that experience.
Right.
And so you had the benefit of coming in contact at the bottom of life in a prison, coming in contact with individuals who have finally seen enough of the light to want to consciously grow their life in that direction.
Right.
And you represent that light. When you come into prison and you are saying the kinds of things that I've heard you talk about to men specifically, I've seen how you've ignited in men, in young men in particular, a sense of purpose. That is transformational.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's what I think for me, that is a gift. That's something that you do that I've always been deeply, deeply appreciative of about our relationship.
Yeah.
Because men are so hungry, Craig.
They're hungry.
Men are so hungry for a word of encouragement and validation. Yeah. And our culture doesn't allow us to say it that way.
Yeah.
So you see it expressed in all kinds of other behavior.
Yeah.
But that's what it is, brother.
Do you remember you and I went to a school in a very poor area here in South Africa, and we spoke to a group of boys in a dilapidated, beaten up classroom. Those boys were so encouraged, so inspired. So, you know, I remember we did a pledge at the end and the boys put their fist on their heart and they said, "I'm a man."
Yes.
And I mean, the sense of pride, because no one had told them, "Young man, you're a man. You're enough. You know, Khalil," and I think this is needed so much in the USA, so much in South Africa, working with young men, you know, teenage men, they've come under such fire, haven't they? They've been demonized. They've been called trash. They've been, you know, get in touch with your feminine side, you know. But when you go and tell these boys, you know, boys, in your DNA is a rich heritage of heroism, man, you know. And you say to them, you know, the Titanic, when the Titanic sank, it was over 100 years ago now. Do you know that 75% of the men on that ship died, drowned, 19% of the women? And I say to the guy, you know, I mean, if men were toxic, there would not have been a female survivor on it. But, you know, the men would have used their strength to toss the woman overboard. But instead, they jumped overboard and made space for the woman. And, you know, I mean, that's masculinity. Men are not toxic.
Yes.
Men are not bad. I mean, men, we are designed to be heroes, to be protectors, to be servers, to be givers. To, you know, that's what masculinity is. But it's been so demonized and so messed up, you know, that men end up being angry and wounded and hurt and, you know.
Of course. And we make excuses for our own lack of accountability.
Yeah.
Yeah. It to argue that someone is bad, someone is somehow incapable of being a great human being is absurd.
Absolutely.
If we think that there's anyone around us who's incapable of change, then we're the problem.
Exactly. We all are. You know, we all have that capacity created in the image of God to do amazing, wonderful, phenomenal things. And, you know, I think Khalil, I mean, you and I both agree on this. I know we've talked about it. The lack of mentors and the lack of fathers, you know, is a major issue, isn't it? You know, boys growing up, you know, who do they look to? You know, I mean, who? Because a friend of mine used to say this, you know, there's a stage in a young boy's development where the wind can change direction and you get a hard on, you know, the hormones.
Yeah.
The hormones are, you know, and, you know, you need older men to teach you how to harness this masculine energy, these hormones, you know, because men and women are different, you know, and gloriously different, you know, of equal value, worthy of equal opportunity, but we're different and we need to celebrate that different. And if you say we're the same, we're not the same, you know, we're not the same. Of course, there's overlaps, but, you know, men, young boys need older men to teach them, hey, dude, this is how you behave. This is not how you behave. The discipline, the, you know, without that, boys either become overly feminized or become overly macho. And both of those are completely wrong.
Of course. And look, we're social creatures. We function in groups and, as you have called it, tribes.
Yep.
The idea that a young person somehow grows up and arrives at the kind of views and toxic behavior that so many people point out, it's learned behavior.
It's not in isolation.
It's learned. And that's the key thing to understand. All behavior is learned.
Yep.
The epiphany is it can therefore be unlearned.
Right.
And the role that we have is to help young men, particularly when we find cases of violence and toxic masculinity, to show them examples of healthy masculinity.
Absolutely.
We do not want them to stop being dangerous. We do not want them to lose that aspect of their own identity, which they aspire to express.
Yeah.
And we want them to do it in a healthy way.
100%. Harness it. Harness that
That's
power.
The key.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. Harness it for good. And there's a lot of good that you can do with that energy.
Absolutely. And that energy is needed in the world, isn't it?
Yes, desperately.
Desperately.
It's desperately needed.
Yeah. I mean, when people demonize masculinity, you say, well, you know, the road that you drove on to get here to the studio, you know, who made that road? The oil that is in your car that you know, the petrol, who extracted that? You know, at great physical cost and, you know, men did that. The building, you know, 90% of the build, and it's not to say men are better than women, but we have an incredibly important, powerful role. You know, 9/11, it's amazing. You know, I think 330 first responders died. 300 were men, willingly rushing in, you know, to a burning building to give their lives to, I mean, the fires that we experience, you know, I mean, men, without that, the world is a disaster. Likewise, without women, you know, and this is the thing. This is not a either or battle, is it? It's a both and.
No.
It's a both and. You know, the dance between the masculine and the feminine is just such a beautiful thing.
And it's necessary. It's the thing about it also, Craig, is that I think that for a lot of us, so much is being said in popular culture that challenges how we've always thought about things. And that's good. I welcome that kind of deep dialogue exchange, but the issue is oftentimes it's not deep and it's not a dialogue.
Yeah.
It's just people posting things.
Yeah.
Saying things without any accountability or any history of work in that space.
Right. Well, it's that.
So you could just come along and say it.
It's virtue signaling, isn't it? Don't you hate virtue signaling? People saying things to look good on social media, but they really don't know what they're talking about.
And that's what we have created with this platform.
Yeah.
We've provided a way for people to be more anonymous and to not have any accountability for anything that's said through our social media platforms. And I get it. That's why I say to you that you have to have a certain boldness in this space. You have to be committed to addressing those issues which most people are afraid to even speak about.
Exactly. And, I mean, if we don't do that, where does the truth go? Where does reality go? Where does activism go? You know, I know you and I agree on this. There's nothing more cowardly than sitting behind a keyboard and bombing out some kind of, you know, moral pronouncement, you know, but where's the courage of your convictions? Where's your knowledge about that? You know, so many protesters on campuses, you know, you go and interview them. They don't know what the hell they're talking about. You know, from the river to the sea, you say, well, what river? I don't know. You know, if you're going to protest something, at least understand the context. You know?
But there's no consciousness of that.
No.
Craig, listen, I just recently was talking with someone and they pointed out to me this article where it said that the Trump administration had removed diversity of books from government offices and a whole host of other things. But here's the point they made. He eliminated, his policy eliminated the book, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings by Maya Angelou. But it kept Mein Kampf by Adolf Hitler.
Yeah.
So when the person told me that, and they were waiting for me for a response from me, I said, wow, that's pretty interesting, isn't it? And they said, yeah, but what do you think? I said, well, if Israel isn't upset about it and Netanyahu isn't on the phone with Trump about it, I don't think I have too much to worry about. Because certainly Maya Angelou, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sing, I can tell you categorically that the majority of Blacks I know have never read it.
Right.
So why would I be angry and upset and now want to go protest because this book has been removed? And I don't even know that it's actually true. I was told that.
Right. Yeah.
And that's how most of us get into these silos. We're told something that we don't even know is actually true.
We don't fact check, do we?
We don't fact check it.
Yeah.
But we have an emotional reaction to
it. Right. Well, that's the thing that the confirmation bias, say, you know.
Yes.
Tell me what I want to hear and I'm going to believe it. Tell me something that I don't agree with, I'm going to reject it. And that, you know, that even goes to funding of research at universities.
Oh, of course.
Right? You get funding.
Of course.
To confirm the biases of the people providing the funding, the ideologies.
Yeah, I mean, yes.
Ideology is such a dread. You know, we need to really cut through ideology. You know, if ideology drives our education system, it depends who's in power, what ideology is going to, you know, and where's the truth? Where's the truth?
And that's why I say, for me, my true north is always a reflection of how I've assessed the alignment of my actions with what I say I believe, what I say I value.
Yeah.
My true north is my responsibility.
Yeah. Yeah.
I can't outsource that. I can't allow someone else to do the work for me that I can only do for myself.
Absolutely.
So I just think that we're in a period where the so-called disruption that a lot of people are complaining about, in America specifically, there's a real anger simmering around the changes that we're seeing with the Trump administration in particular.
Right.
And it's become so divisive that people are actually trying to cancel you based on who you vote for.
That's crazy, isn't it?
It's based on who you vote for.
It's dehumanizing. They put you in a box. You voted this or that, you're in a box. And therefore, you know, I judge you completely.
And to think about that, that you somehow can put me in a box because of how I vote in this particular election, is just insanity. Yeah. And I think one of the things that really stood out to me was, I heard Trump say to a group, if I created a cure for cancer, you hate me so much that you wouldn't even accept it.
I think he's right. Yeah, well, what do they call it?
I think
Trump derangement syndrome. Yeah. It's real. Yeah.
And what I'm saying is, Craig, I don't have time, the energy, or even an inclination to dislike any human being for any reason that makes me get up every day and want to cancel them.
Especially,
like, I just don't have that kind of energy.
No. And it's so limiting. It's anti-intellectual, isn't it? You know, let's find what's right. Everyone has error and everyone has some truth, you know, and obviously the ratio varies from person to person, but let's find the truth and let's give credit where credit's due and let's call out where we need to call out.
Yeah, there's a lot of room for growth on all sides, lot of room. Yeah. And I just think that ultimately, the more of us who own our own role and our own responsibilities, we will have much more of an opportunity to make meaningful change, sustainable change. Because even if the world was changed overnight, if our thinking and our behavior stayed the same, we wouldn't be able to enjoy it.
No, we wouldn't. Yeah. Because the change starts with me, doesn't it?
Yes, because ultimately, whatever happens in the world is an internal experience for each individual. Yeah. So both of us seeing and experiencing the same thing can have very different reactions to it. Yeah. And because our reactions can be so different, it's even more important that we find some common ground to acknowledge and respect each other's shared humanity.
I love that, because don't you think that, you know, almost everybody in the world, if they sat down and talked proper dialogue, would find that there's more in common than there is not. You know, what do we want? We want safety, security. We want love. We want respect. We want to be able to provide for. I mean, the commonalities, the human commonalities, are way, way, way bigger than what divides us. But when you don't listen, when you don't talk, when you don't open your ears and respect and look in the mirror, as you said, you focus on the tiny things and you lose track of the vast area of commonality that we all as humans have.
Absolutely. And that's where I think all of that gets amplified through social media.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because it allows a singular negative comment to take on immense kind of meaning in the context of a platform that spreads it immediately, instantly. Yeah.
And assumes that it's true.
Assuming that it's true. Yeah. And this is the whole thing. Most of us don't spend any considerable time fact-checking the information that we receive. It's just not, like, it's just not what we do.
Especially if it agrees with my point of view.
Why check it? It feels good. It sounds right.
Yeah.
So there's no need to check any of that. And that's how we walk through life. Yeah. Because realistically, as human beings, the things that we think and say are reflections of impressions that we've received in our lives. We have been influenced by these pieces.
We have a worldview, and we also have wounds that are triggers, you know, that trigger us.
Absolutely. Yeah. And they're real.
They're real.
And if we do not acknowledge the impact that they have on us, if we, and a lot of times we don't acknowledge it because we're unaware of how it's affecting us.
Yeah. We live unconsciously. We live by default.
Of course.
We go from day to day, week to week, you know, relationship to relationship without really introspecting and looking, you know, what are the roles of my worldview and my wounds on this? You know, where am I to blame with how this has gone wrong here? Unless we do that.
Brother, you said just how you're linking wounds to worldview is a really powerful way to think about our triggers.
Right.
Your worldview can be wonderful. I mean, it can be really, really inspiring. The fact of the wounds is what we run the real danger with. Right. We don't see how those wounds are impacting that worldview in our relationships.
So much so. You know, I mean, a young girl growing up has an abusive father. She hates men. It's a result of an action, a bad, an evil action of a father. You know, one race group might have a bad experience, violent interaction with another race group. They label the entire, you know, they've got prejudice now based on one experience. The wound informs their worldview. It informs their prejudice, which is often unjustified.
I just think I look at a specific example in my own case. Growing up in America and ultimately going to prison for choices that I made, and being a very angry young man, confused, directionless. And quite frankly, just reckless.
Right.
I found myself in prison at the bottom of life. And I realized that I had to do something different. That there were changes I needed to make in order for me to change my circumstances. And so I went on doing that work. Now, what I can tell you is this. There are a few things that happened along the way that really opened my consciousness up to just how limiting my own beliefs were. And I can tell you, having served time in prison and getting out and having the idea that because I was in prison, it's going to be much more difficult to get a job. People are going to hold this against me. Well, when I moved to South Africa, think of this. In America, having spent all those years in prison and the additional factor of being Black, all those things play into the kind of collective consciousness, if you will, here in America.
You're a bad man. You're labeled as a bad man.
I'm a bad guy. Yeah. I'm just a bad person. Yeah. I mean, that's part of the cultural baggage, the cultural
definition. More than that, you're dangerous. You're to be avoided.
Yes. When I got to South Africa, it's a funny thing. The entire ruling party had been to prison.
And they were all Black.
If you hadn't been to prison, you were looked at with suspicion.
So you went from zero to hero.
Yeah, from zero to hero just by changing my environment. But then the other side of it was, so I'm walking around thinking, wow, this is not bad at all. My hero's been to prison. This is good. Hey, but here's the thing. What I soon recognized is that a lot of the things that I thought were because I had been in prison or perhaps because I was Black no longer held the same meaning once I was in South Africa.
Right.
Because I was discriminated against there. Just think about it.
Yeah.
By Blacks.
Yeah, right. What, for being American?
So, for being American.
Right.
And in other instances, people treated me extraordinarily well
because I was a
hero. So the idea that somehow this is unique to any particular group, the pettiness, lack of sensitivity, the pure inhumanity of some of the things that we say and do to each other. Mm-hmm. That's across the board, wherever you go in the world.
It's the human condition.
It's the human condition. Yeah. And so much of what is the human condition gets conflated with our ideologies race,
right,
of gender, of all those other things. Mm. We're not seeing through the mist, through the clouds. And because we're not, we keep relying on bankrupt explanations, inadequate solutions.
100%.
It has to start with us.
And detribalizing ourselves. You know, I'm not who I am because of my tribe. I'm not who I am because of my color, ethnicity, whatever, nationality. I am who I am because of the unique individual that I am, which is human being. And as are you.
Absolutely.
Imagine if we could all see each other like that. Completely look beyond the tribe, the whatever it is, and look at the heart, the soul, the human. Who is Khalil? You know, I mean, Khalil, I must say, when we, you know, there are not many guys you meet where you think this is a brother. You know, I really felt that when we first met. You know,
that's the whole point.
I mean,
that's
there's a connection.
Inspired our conversation.
Exactly. Yeah, and I mean, we need more of that, don't we? You know, it's you know,
there's no question about it, brother. Look, when you drill all the way down to our humanity, just giving ourselves an opportunity to breathe for a second without being black, without being white, without being any of those titles that we've given ourselves, just to sit as a life.
Yep.
And to recognize that as a life, as life itself, I actually can observe my thoughts. Mm. I can observe my emotions.
Right.
I can observe them before anyone sees my behavior. I can literally sit with myself and reflect on the nature of my thinking and the nature of my emotions. Now, the mere fact that I can do that means I'm not the thing I'm looking at.
Right.
The mere fact that I can look at my thoughts about race and assess those thoughts means I'm not that thought.
Right.
I can look at a chair and assess the chair because I'm not the chair. If at any time I get confused and start thinking I'm the chair, it looked pretty ridiculous for me walking around with a chair attached to
me. I'm not going to sit on you, I promise.
Exactly. So the thing is that we have to recognize is that we are more than the thoughts we have.
And we have the agency to adjust them and to amend them.
To adjust, that's the agency. That's where, because some people don't believe they have that kind of power.
Sure.
They believe that they think the way they do, they feel the way they do, and they behave the way they do because they say, that's just who I am.
What a cop-out. Isn't that a cop-out? Huh? I mean,
It is totally a cop-out to say, that's just who I am. No.
Yeah.
That's who you have compulsively become.
Chosen to be.
Yes. And you have responsibility for that.
Yeah.
You cannot blame someone else for that, even though we know we are influenced by our environment. Right. I mean, singularly, the most important and decisive shaper of behavior is environment.
Absolutely.
We get it. But at a deeper level, as human beings, we have a responsibility to create our environment, to modify our environment, to change it to such an extent that it now becomes a way to facilitate everything we want to do rather than a barrier to who we want to become.
Environment
doesn't, that's human.
It doesn't determine who we are. It shapes who we are, but we decide how we respond to it. It's beautiful. I mean, Khalil, I've just been indicated we need to start rapping, but I'm excited. You know, I'm excited about man-to-man talks, mantomantalks.com. You know, the truth that we will bring to organizations and corporations and campuses around reconciliation, around truth, working together with love, about overcoming cancel culture, about stop virtue signaling, about grace, about redemption, about humanity. I mean, this is just, it's just such a needed conversation. And I'm just so excited, man, to be doing it with you. It's interesting. An American, a South African, a black man, a white man, you know, with totally different pasts. You know, I mean, it embodies that whole thing of humanity, man, brotherhood. And
absolutely. And brother, this has been the thing that I'm most inspired about is the fact that from day one, you and I have had really meaningful, actually deep and challenging conversations.
Yeah.
From the beginning, we had deep questions to ask each other. We had things that we were thinking as men that we needed to have a conversation about. Yeah. And that transcended our differences.
Right. Absolutely. It literally
transcended our differences.
Well, they evaporated, didn't they? Evaporated.
Yes. Because if you can allow yourself to actually be comfortable with your own humanity, which is to say the fact that you don't have all the answers, the fact that you need help, the fact that there are other men in your life around you who are healthy and who are positive and who are good and who are aspiring to be a friend and a soldier and a brother.
Right.
That, and it had nothing to do with race, to actually know that there are human beings in the world who can embrace you in ways that go beyond your race.
It's beautiful.
Brother, that's the relationship that we have had. And that is why, for me, it has been extraordinary. Mm. That's why.
Yeah.
Because right from the beginning, there was a connection that we shared that came from something deep within us that we recognized as men in each other, this power.
Right. Beautiful.
And we both were already at a stage in our lives where we saw the value of using it for good.
Beautiful. You know, I mean, I also saw this in you, and I think this is what I say to me. You know, we need to be both warriors and poets, warriors and lovers, you know. I mean, there's a time when you don't cry. There's a time when you take it on the chin. There's a time when you put on your armor and you get out there and fight. But there's a time when you take it off and you can cry and you're soft and gentle. I mean, and that when you see that in a brother, it's a beautiful thing. And I think that's what we need to inspire in men.
Of course,
be warriors, man. Be strong. Be tough. Be dangerous. But be good warriors. Be lovers and carers as well. You know, and I mean, I'm looking forward to spreading that message far and wide, man, and helping young men to step up and be that.
This is great, brother. I'm excited about the work we're doing.
Me too.
I'm excited about this conversation. Absolutely. And most importantly, I think it's essential that this kind of message gets out so that we can encourage other men to move beyond the barriers that they've allowed to keep them from each other.
What a powerful note to end on. Brother, that's awesome. We'll chat soon again.
Looking forward to it, brother.
Likewise.